Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. We're thrilled to have the launch party of The Elicitor here. Gloucester High School is very near and dear to my heart, as I am Mrs. Cook, married to Mr. Cook. And I was in The Elicitor 25 years ago. So it's a nice turn of events to have you all here today to celebrate this new edition of The Elicitor. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Giglio to talk about The Elicitor.
Okay, good evening. My name is Kim Trigilio, and I would like to thank you all for being here with us tonight. I am pleased to welcome our contributors and their families and their friends as we launch the Winter 2019 Elicitor. I just want to take a moment to thank those who helped make this event happen. Amanda Cook, thank you. Stevens Brosnahan, the Gloucester Writers Center, and the Gloucester Education Foundation. This would not be possible without you. So tonight, you will hear from the talented young writers, photographers, and artists whose work is represented in the pages of The Elicitor. But before we begin, I just want to say a few words about the editors. Kat, they're hovering over there. Kat Canavandisa, Mila Berry, and Willa Brosnahan. So each one of these remarkable young women is uniquely talented in her own right. But their combined creative energy has been a powerful force. And I think this issue of The Elicitor is a testament to their collaboration, their dedication, their determination, and drive. I'm so very proud of them and all they have accomplished. I'm going to turn the mic over to the students now because that's who we came to hear. Let us all welcome your MC for the evening, co-editor of The Elicitor, Willa Brosnahan.
Thank you, Ms. T. Hi, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I'm Willa Brosnahan, a name I'm sure most of our contributors are familiar with due to the pretty constant stream of emails I've been pestering them with for the last couple of months. Publishing a literary magazine is something that my co-editors, Mila and Kat, and I have never done before. The process was full of unplanned hurdles and plot twists, and we couldn't have done it without you, our writers and artists. We would also like to thank Ms. Trigilio, to whom this edition of The Elicitor is dedicated. Her perseverance through thick and thin has inspired us to work together and problem solve, and her guidance forever leads us to push ourselves as writers, editors, and artists. A big thank you to the Gloucester Writers Center and Amanda Cook as well for hosting us in this space and making the launch possible. I would like to draw a little more attention to Kat over there, who is the graphic designer behind The Elicitor. Without her expertise, there is no way we would have been able to make such a professional-looking magazine. Your diligence and attention to detail is essential to our team, and we are so, so lucky to have you. I'm excited to turn the stage over to featured poet Catherine Bevins, who will be reading her poetry published in The Elicitor, including the Poetry Without Paper third-place winning poem, Photosynthesis of a Relationship.
So I'm going to only read two that are in here, but like Willa said, I'm going to read the first one I'm going to read is Photosynthesis of a Relationship, which was a third place winner for Poetry Without Paper. When she met him, something was different. He was not like any of the others. He was pure and gentle. They were young. But for some reason, she fell for him. She fell for the way he admired her and not her body. He made her laugh. He was cute. Not like, OMG, he's so hot, but for the I can't stop thinking about him way. They talked and he held her hand and something for once seemed right. There was something about his innocence that made her feel safe. But it didn't take long for him to change his mind. She opened up only for him to judge her and leave her. And now years later, she thought to herself, now I'm the one that would beg for a chance, but he is a flower and I am only the clouds that deprive him of the sun. Next, I'm going to read one that was kind of inspired after freshman year English in Ms. Trigilio's class. We were reading Romeo and Juliet, and we had a debate about whether or not people believed in love at first sight, and I thought it was sort of stupid, so I kind of wrote this. It's called Compliments. I don't believe in love at first sight. Because if it was such a thing, he would have called me ambitious instead of hot. That's what I'm going to read.
Sharing with us next is Fisher. I should introduce you. A current senior at Gloucester High School, since 2015, he has followed his passion of visual art, specifically in the fields of photography and filmmaking. His favorite subjects to shoot include cities, cars, and people, those that are posed, as well as those on the street who are going about their daily lives. After high school, he plans to pursue a career in finance, but notes that photography and the arts will be something that I hold close to me until the day I die.
Alrighty, so I have a presentation up right here. In the Elicitor, I wrote an essay about my journey through photography, how I started. So you can all see that there. So instead, I'm just going to talk about some of the work I have in it and some of my favorite pieces. So as she noted, some of my favorite subjects are people, cars, cities. So these are some of my favorite portraits I've taken. I enjoy taking pictures of people, posed, especially, and candid and in the streets. So if you want to go to the next slide, this is some of my more favorite work that I have. This picture right here was featured in the Elicitor. I just like something about taking pictures of people, very candid and raw. Stories behind most of these pictures of in the streets is just wandering around with my camera for hours, usually in Boston. Whenever I go to New York City, it's just wandering the streets, trying to take pictures, capturing people's faces, and just them going about their daily lives. So you can go to the next slide. I like cars a lot. I drive a 2006 Honda Pilot, so I don't get much excitement in the field of cars every day. So when I see them, I like capturing them in the ways that I think are cool. That's the way I can enjoy taking pictures of cars. So most of these pictures are usually just walking around, sometimes in parking garages, on the side of the street, sometimes car shows, and I just like capturing what I think looks cool to me. You can go to the next slide. And then in urban environments, this is really how I kind of started. I love the city of Boston. I'm probably going to end up going to school next year there. So just walking around Boston, looking at what other people take pictures of and trying to put my own spin on things. Whether it's wandering through the subways down here, taking pictures of the tunnels. That's shot in New York City at nighttime from Brooklyn, Chicago. And a lot of these pictures, some of them, like this one in the top left, it spent hours just looking at Google Maps, trying to find cool places to take pictures, buildings that might have cool vantage points. And when I get those shots, it's really, truly something special. The top one on the right, that's Columbus Circle in New York City. That was featured. I put that in the Elicitor. And that was just one of those shots that I spent hours researching, trying to find a place take that shot, and when I got it, I couldn't have been happier. And then these are just some more of my abstract miscellaneous pieces that I just enjoy taking because I just think they're cool. This one right here in the middle of the yacht, that was in the Elicitor. That I took with a drone. In the summertime, I spend a lot of time at 10 Pound Island, and whenever cool boats come into the harbor, kind of like those, I try to put my own spin on them, capture them in ways that I think are cool. And then I also enjoy going to abandoned places. That's an abandoned train in Boston that I was able to get into a couple times, and just being able to capture that in my own light was something pretty cool, being able to get to it.
Our next contributor is senior Emma Killian, who will be attending Gordon College next year to study creative writing, and has published a book of poetry called Chapter One. She will be reading her poem Blackbird, which is published in the Elicitor, among other works.
Hi, so I'm going to read you this poem in here called Blackbird, as Willa said. And I guess just a quick thing about this was I had to write a poem for my creative writing class, and it was supposed to be like a narrative poem, so it had to tell a story, and I had no idea what I wanted it to be about. And all I could think of that for some reason that day was birds. Like, that was the only thing that would come into my head. And like that day, I kind of felt like a lot of my friends didn't really, like, they felt like they were in a place where they didn't see what was going on around them, and they weren't, like, noticing, like, all the opportunities that I saw that they had. So I just wanted this poem to kind of say, like, don't wait to see, like, what opportunities you have right now. Everything around stood still as she waited patiently till she saw a blackbird flying fast over every gray tree. In a moment, it was gone. All went back to its still state. She hoped she'd see more movement as she continued to wait. But after years of waiting, she decided to walk home. Nothing to her had changed as she watched the planet grow. And she wondered yet again if the gears would ever turn. Would a spark ever appear to make the fire inside burn? So when she returned home at the start of a long night, she tried to fall asleep in hopes it would speed up her life. But when the blackbird hit the window, she was woken by the sound. And when she went to see what happened, she saw the bird dead on the ground. But when it flew fast through the sky, it had blocked out all the light, for she noticed all its feathers were the brightest shade of white. I have one more that I'll read to you, which is not in the Elicitor. It's in this book that Willa mentioned that I had published, and this one is called Dirt. I once read a poem where somebody had told that every flower had to grow through dirt to become beautiful. And then they had added they believed they were no seed. They were only the dirt in which the flowers were conceived. But if we didn't have others to help us through hard times, would we ever make it to our long-lost finish lines? So if all you think you are is dirt, it's important that you know that without you there is nowhere for any seed to grow.
All right, our next speaker is the cover artist for this edition of The Elicitor. It's a sophomore, Natasha Baumgartel. She has been making art her whole life and hopes to pursue a career in the arts.
Hi, just a warning, I'm kind of losing my voice at the moment, so this might not be the best. So, firstly, thank you, Willa, Mila, and Kat, for making this actually happen. This is awesome. So, art is everything, especially to me. I've been passionate about it my whole life. I've always known that I wanted what I wanted to do. I tend to go to college for it, and definitely wanted to be a career. So, next slide. This is my piece. I call it Synthesis. I made it with acrylic paint and black Sharpie. So first I painted like this fluid background using a cool palette, and then I painted on these characters, and then I went over with a black Sharpie to more like define them. To me, it's supposed to more talk about how each character is supposed to be different and show how they express and deal with, particularly it's supposed to represent like strife or, you know, along those lines, how each person expresses it differently. Next slide. These are some of my other work, which I didn't submit to the Elicitor, but what I'm working on currently. I just finished the one on the right 2 days ago, and the one on the left has been worked on since. She has another eyebrow now. So the one on the bottom right is actually like a collection that's paired with the one that I submitted. As you can see, the flowers are similar. And painted on the left is a small, it's probably only like that big. And the top right was just kind of supposed to be a background. There wasn't much of a front round to it. This one was also part of the series that I made. The flowers are similar. And then the middle is a collage. I cut small pieces of just a magazine, and just so you couldn't even tell what it was, and then I just glued it on. And the right is with oil paint. So, thank you. That's it.
Next, we have Madison Lang, who is a staff writer for the Gilknitter and a member of Drama Club, who will be sharing some of her photographs with us.
All right, so I've been doing photography since my sophomore year, and in my pictures, I focused a lot on color and like the color in nature. And so in the first picture, this is the one I have in the Elicitor. In class, we do something called camera walk, and it's just like a random collection of pictures that we use, and we select from that. And this was originally just part of that, but then I ended up submitting it to Scholastic, and I got an honorable mention in Scholastic for it. And that's the only thing I did submit in the Elicitor, and I'm looking to submit more in the next one. That's just outside my house, and I really enjoy. I saturated the picture, but it still was like almost that bright in nature, and I'm doing a personal project on it now because I enjoyed like how it looks so much, and I really like the silhouettes in front of it. And so then the next picture is one I took in front of Marshall's. And this one was just like right as the sun was starting to set, and I just love how it looks, and with Market Basket in the background and the colors, and I just want to explore that more, and it's really something that I found passion in, looking at the sky and different parts of like the day. Like, I want to try to get sunrise if I can wake up that early. I know. And I want to try to do nighttime soon with star trails, but I haven't done that yet. So my next picture too is something similar. And that one's outside of the school, and that one I hadn't edited, and this one I just took on my phone. Some of my pictures I do take on my phone, and I submit those because it's kind of capturing things that I wouldn't be able to catch if with my camera, because these are just like moments of my day that I take out, and I just enjoy like little snippets. And most of my pictures are with cameras, but some of them are with my phone because I see something and I just want to capture it. This one I took on my camera. This is one of my favorite pictures I've taken. It's the sun glare after I went apple picking, so it was in fall, and the colors just really remind me of that time. And I like using colors to like connect to memories and different times of the year. And then my last picture is different than the rest of them because I do other work too. Mm-hmm. That one's of the grass outside, and this one had the strong green in it, and it reminded me more of summertime because this is when I took this at the start of the year. This is one from when I first started photography, and I want to explore things like this. Yep, that's.
Next is Autumn, a sophomore who enjoys painting and writing. She will be reading an excerpt from her short story, The Greenhouse.
So I'm only going to be reading like the first like page and a half, but I figured that is like the best way to open the story. Robert Browning once said, "Motherhood, all love begins and ends there." In childhood, when the likes of encyclopedias and novels promise dignification and maturity, a set few young minds develop their first sinful dispositions. They are word gluttons, driven by pride. Self-assuredly intellectual, they will take great pleasure in spitting quotes at whomever's ear turns their way. They care not what they say, for often they do not understand. Archibald liked Browning. It was mere chance, as one may find it often is. Grubby kindergartners will worm their way into their father's studies and pluck books from the shelves as they may pluck apples from trees. Browning was on some of the lower shelves in Mr. McCraven's umber den. And so, at the age of 7, Archie found himself indulging in the delicacies of poetry. The words themselves were of little substance to him, but he greatly enjoyed the way they felt rolling around in his head. Sometimes, very quietly, he'd sound them out aloud. If he liked the way the words tasted, he'd speak a little louder.
He'd chant flowery phrases in the dim of the lamplit study, and when, minutes later, his father would enter to chase him, Archie would scold himself for having been too loud. The late spring of 1968 marked the beginning of change in Archie's life. Mr. McRaven pledging himself to the Vietnam War was taken as a blessing. Without his father, Archibald became the man of the house, and though he cared little for the responsibilities that came with such a title, it did allow him access to his father's study. This was a blissful era for young Archie. Warm days were spent lounging about in the vegetable gardens of his backyard, flipping through borrowed books. That fall, Madame McRaven occupied herself by having a greenhouse built against the back fence of their yard. The tomato plants and carrot patches that Archie had oh so adored were excavated. This new greenhouse held no sweet, sticky berries for young boys to snack on. Rather, it was blooming with flowers. Madame McRaven, in absence of her husband, fawned over bushels of marigolds and puckered little petunias. Archibald, after plucking an orchid, was banished from his mother's greenhouse, just as he had once been from his father's study. Inadvertently, he had a newfound loathing for the dark wooden room. His interest in the melancholy ramblings of ghosts had been replaced with his own woeful desires. As winter crept upon the McRavens, Archie found himself, day after day, looking out on the faint glow of the greenhouse, warm and inviting. There was a long while before Madame McRaven cued her son in on what had happened, and by that point, Archibald had figured enough to come to his own understanding. An accident was all it was, really. Something of a misfire of his own gun. To be shot in the head and survive is both a miracle and damnation. Madame McRaven didn't disclose his handicappedness was at his own fault, but rather had come up with an elaborate patriotic speech. She had memorized the script so dutifully, it is likely she'd grown to believe it herself, for a while at least. It should be known that Madame McRaven was a proud woman, she who had never had much, but who had worked her very hardest to milk every drop of exquisite wine that the teat of life had to offer. Perhaps in knowing this, one might not feel sympathy as she abandons her son and mentally crippled husband, but mayhaps an ounce of understanding. It had been days before Archibald's 10th birthday. An untouched cake sat dutifully in the fridge and remained there for many months. Archie had known the day his mother disappeared, as he sat on the front lawn watching the sunset, that she would not be returning. To be posed with such a situation brought no questions to the stark reality he brought no questions to his mind as it would perhaps bring to any of ours, but rather Archibald looked only at the stark reality he was faced with. The solution was simple, solely because it was non-existent. All there was to do was to carry on as he had. The next morning, and every morning which followed, Archie let himself into the greenhouse. There was a guilty pleasure here, a secret joy that with his mother gone, the gates of Eden were open to him. Tending to the flowers was easy. Unlike the vegetables of his childhood, flowers require little attention, for they do not rot. If they shed their petals, they did so in private. To Archibald, they were suspended in their beauty, eternally stunted in their prime. Caring for his father was suspiciously similar to caring for the greenhouse. As they were suspended in their beauty, he was suspended in himself. Docile as a lamb, he required only to be fertilized and watered, and perhaps propped up in the sunlight from time to time. Archie fell easily into routine. It was fairly monotonous, consisting mainly of simple day-to-day tasks. There were Fridays, though, when he took the bus into town and bought groceries. And then, of course, there was Nellie.
Okay, now we have Galad, a sophomore at GHS who enjoys video games, coding, drawing, cooking, and baking. He wrote the recipe that you can find in the Elicitor, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what baking means to him and how he came to enjoy cooking.
Hi. So, baking means a lot more than just, like, cooking to me. Like, when people imagine baking and making food and stuff like that, all you'd really think is just you throw a bunch of stuff into a pot or a pan or something and you chuck it into the oven and comes out a beautiful cake or something like that. And that's not really how it is. So when I got into, like, cooking and stuff, and I enjoyed cooking, I liked making food, and I liked that you could tune things a little bit, and it really opened up a lot of creativity. Like when you're making something like a stir fry or something, you can add a little salt or add a little pepper, some spices and stuff. And even if you add a little too much, it'll still come out fine. It'll just be a little too salty or a little too spicy or something like that. And so I thought the next obvious step from cooking would be baking. And I thought that that kind of tuning and creativity was similar. But boy, was I wrong. It's not. And a lot of people know that, and they think that the difference between cooking and baking is astronomical, and that you can't really open up the kind of creativity in baking that you can in cooking. But that's also not necessarily true. Like, what people think is, like, when you're baking and you have baking soda or something like that, you add a little too much, and what ends up happening is the entire thing ends up getting ruined, which is true to a sense, but it's not really those kind of basic chemical aspects that you need to worry about. It's like if you add a little too much, adding a little bit too much milk or like chocolate chips or something, that's where you can really open up in your creativity and decorating and stuff like that. So to backtrack a little bit, I started baking relatively, like just a while, not too long ago, like only about 2 years ago I started. And when you think about starting baking, like, you'd imagine you start with something like chocolate chips, like chocolate chip cookies or cupcakes or something like that. I started with croissants, and that was a terrible mistake. So I was like, it was early in the morning, like, I want to bake something. Just, I woke up, didn't think about baking at all before the next day. I was like, you know what? I'm going to bake croissants today. So I go downstairs, I look up all these recipes, and I realize, wait a minute, all of these take multiple days to make, and I'm impatient. So I went and found this one recipe that said you can make these croissants in a day, and they look pretty good. And I was like, yo, I'm going to make these. And instead of starting with something relatively easy like chocolate chip cookies or cupcakes, something like that, I just went right into that, and it went downhill from there. I was like, well, this is going to be the test to see if I like baking or not. And that's not really giving it a fair shot, right? It's like you're, whatever, it doesn't matter. I was going to start baking, and I was like, okay, this is going to be the test to see if I like baking or not. And so I start making it, and I realize, wait a minute, this is difficult, right? Because the reason that this croissant recipe was only made in a day was because it required a lot more attention than regular croissants. With regular croissants, you take it out, you do something, and you leave it back in and wait another day and then do it again. With this, you had to, like, every 2 hours, you have to take it back out and do the same thing over and over again. You have to, like, cheat the proving process. And it was kind of sketchy. So I'd keep doing that, and it was really, really difficult, right? I kept going, and I was like, this is not fun. I had to grab this big slab of butter, and just, and it was like folding it over itself and putting it in the fridge for half an hour, just sitting there waiting, listening to music, and like, he's like, hey, you want to hang out today? He's like, sorry, can't. I'm baking croissants. And I go back into the fridge, take it out, fold it, put it back in, take it out, and eventually I get to the part where this is like the hardest part of making croissants is when you have to start folding it onto itself. Because if you make it too thick, it just doesn't work. It unfolds and all the butter melts, and it's a big mess. So I'm starting to do that, right? I'm folding it up, and it's like I screwed up really bad. And luckily, the croissant, it's a teeny bit forgiving in that you have two chances to do it. It gives you two batches of eight, right? The first one, I was like, this is going to be it. I'm going to do it. And it was miserable. It melted. It was terrible, and it was really bad. And I was like, I was so upset. And I was like, I don't like this. And I just threw it away, and I got really mad, but there was still the other piece of dough. So I was like, fine. And I took it out, and I was a little more I was like a little more patient, because I was really frustrated. And I was, the first batch, I was a little too cocky, and I was thinking I could do this. And then I realized I need to come back with a lens of patience. And so I went back with that, and I was able to do it, and it was a little bit better. And I popped them in the oven. And, well, first, before you can even pop them in the oven, you have to make them, and then you have to put them in the fridge again, and then take them out, and then you can butter them, and then put them back in the fridge, and then you can take them back out, and then you can put them in the oven. And by that time, it was, like, 10 at night, and everyone's having, like, finishing up dinner, and I'm like, I have to go. And I go down to the oven, and I'm taking out croissants at 10 at night, and I'm, like, staring at these croissants, and I'm, like, taking a picture of them. And I was, like, just staring at these croissants, and it was way late at night, and I'd done, like, wasted my entire Sunday, and I was like, I love this.
Okay, up next we have Abby Cook, a GHS freshman who likes Dungeons and Dragons and Doctor Who. She will be reading an excerpt from her short story, The Flats.
I don't like my writing, so I'm going to read as little as I can. I'm just going to read the beginning. On the eastern coast of the Kingdom of Alfra lies the mudflats. Here, the low tide mark sits nearly 2 miles away from an average high tide. The tide steadily creeps inwards, drastically changing the landscape in only 6 hours. A traveler walking on the sand could find herself wading in waist-deep ocean in an hour and swimming in another. Legend tells us that originally the flats were entirely underwater, and that the land is now exposed as a result of a sorcerer's failed attempt at creating a new land for his kingdom. Whatever caused the environment of the flats to change so drastically happened centuries ago. Now people have been making their homes on the flats for generations. Towns on the flats rise and fall like the tides. One town will begin to fail after several fishing expeditions come back empty-handed, and the survivors will leave and build another one. Every child that lives on the flats has heard stories of entire settlements being destroyed from an unnatural tide or storm, but no one alive can remember an event like this. At the northern tip of the flats lies the ruins of a small town called Forgale. For decades, it was the most prosperous town on any coast. Families would come from all over to start a new life, fishing or running any of the numerous shops. Like most other towns on the flats, it was made up of houses, shops, and schools built on stilts. It was centered around the school, which was surrounded by a ring of shops, which was surrounded by several rings of houses. The Turin family lived on the outskirts of Forgale. Haman Turin ran a blacksmith in the center of town. He made weapons for fishermen and travelers alike, as monsters lurked beneath the surface. His wife, Anna, was a fisherwoman, and she would leave for weeks at a time to catch fish far off the coast. They had 4 children, the 2 oldest of which were the only 2 to survive the destruction of Forgale. When school ended that day, the tide was low enough for the 4 siblings to walk home. It wasn't that far, though they suspected they may have to swim a few feet in the process. Ayla, the oldest of the 4, at 14, and A, the 2nd oldest at 12, led the way with their 9-year-old brothers trailing behind, picking up various shells and rocks and stuffing them in their pockets. "Hurry up, Nil and Nim," Ayla called back to them. "Mom's back tonight, remember?" The 2 boys looked at her. It finally dawned on them that they would be seeing their mother, and they dashed ahead, racing to their house. "I guess they didn't remember," A laughed. A and Ayla ran after their brothers. In no time at all, the 4 had reached the house. They climbed up on the wooden 10-foot ladder, skillfully evading the colonies of barnacles that lived upon it, up to the deck around the house. The wood was wet and slippery, but the siblings were all used to that. By now, the water was about 6 inches deep, higher than normal, and slowly creeping higher. The children's parents had not yet arrived at their house. Haman had gone to pick up his wife at the dock, taking the family's boat. A and Ayla decided to spend this extra time studying for upcoming tests while Nil and Nim emptied their pockets and observed their collection. An hour or two passed in this manner, with all 4 occasionally checking the window, eagerly awaiting their parents' return. The water had risen over 6 feet by the time Haman and Anna arrived. It was strange to have the water this high, but neither of them thought much of it as they docked by the house and climbed the little bit of ladder still above water to the deck around the house. A noticed almost immediately that her parents were here. "Mom, Mom," she called, flying out of the front door to the deck, followed closely by her siblings. They all hugged their mother, who was a little wet from the boat ride, but they didn't care. "Come, come," Haman guided his children to the door. "Let's catch up, shall we?" A and Ayla nodded and began herding their brothers into the house. Haman and Anna walked behind them, arm in arm. "Did you make her another sword, Dad?" A asked once everybody was inside. The boys immediately cleaned up their collection and disposed of it in their room before joining the older members of their family. "Another sword?" Anna chuckled. "You know I don't need a brand new weapon every time I go out to sea." "Well, the most beautiful fisherwoman of all Forgale deserves one," Haman responded, fishing through his bag to find the sheath that contained the swords he had crafted especially for his wife. "Do you need help, Dad?" A offered. "No, thanks," Haman responded. "It looks as though I've forgotten it. I guess the Great Warrior will have to wait another day to be presented with her weapon." "I can get it," A jumped up from her seat beside her mother. Haman laughed and nodded. "Yes, go, go. Just bring back the boat in one piece." A nodded and dashed out the door. "I shall return," she called barely audibly as she began to row away. And then they all die, and it's pretty interesting.
Reading next is sophomore Mila Berry, my dear friend and co-editor of The Elicitor. Her work has been an inspiration to me personally as a writer for a long time.
Tonight she will be reading an excerpt from her short story, The Inverse Angels.
Alrighty. So I also wrote this story, as a lot of other people here have, for school, for my English class, just a couple months ago. And I really didn't like it at first, but I think I've grown to like it more now that it's in the Illicitor. And I'm just going to read you the first page. So, The Inverse Angels. The unanchored stars reeled across unfinished night, like a thousand worms trying to bore a hole in the sun. And in the pre-dawn blue, the mushrooms came up, hundreds of them, in a rolling tide. They tipped their delicate lampshade heads, strange, moist angels, new life among the rot and weed-ridden dead. Like an inverse carpet of grass, and with poppy field precision, they crossed the desolate gap between sagging fence and sleeping door. It was an arduous journey, though short, and spores sent forward on valiant wind gusts were spread to far-reaching corners over many years of sorry ignorance. There was a swing set in the middle, but the fungus climbed over the crusty bars and wilting chains unimpeded, beautiful in their silence, and determined to march to the crease in the earth where house met dirt. It was a tired house, old and damp, bloated with the weight of rain and browning like an overripe fruit. The walls, done in floral paper some 50 years earlier, bore coffee-colored watermarks, which adorned the whiteness like graying blood. Vinyl flooring peeled in the fashion of toenails, yellowing, gnarled, and was covered in some places with shag carpeting, which was disastrously green and laced with must. There were photographs, colored with chalk pastels, or else completely monochromatic, endlessly hopeful in their depiction of the old young again and the long gone even younger. There were books everywhere, and toys some places, and brittleness like a disease spreading gently and slowly, memory by rickety memory. Sometimes the mail grew into great piles, and the entryway smelled like ink and paper and yellow. And it was always dark, as though the seeping moisture sank from deep within the ceiling into the light fixtures, and let them fizzle out into flickering nothingness. It was a quiet place, except for the mushrooms, who were quiet too until they sank into the ground at daybreak. It was quiet and cool, except for the last bedroom on the third floor, which sat thick and stuffy. That was where Sonny slept. He liked the door to stay tightly sealed at night, out of caution for some inscrutable ghostly presence, though perhaps he hoped for it more than feared. His dresser was swaddled in moldering clothes, and around his bed, like a jungle, rose a savage mass of chaotic nostalgia. All the things from lives gone by shoved and boxed and haphazardous, stacked as though they somehow brought him closer to what he could no longer reach. Now he stared out from the far east window, partially obscured by grime and faded curtains, watching the young day grow into itself, burn hot and bright and fast, and then fall dark behind the horizon. It was brisk, a bluebird sky shot with late autumn chill, and Sonny wondered with distaste at how solemn the earth looked so late in this year's life. The ending of green summer's glory filled him with unease. It did not help that his brother Jeb was coming for his annual visit this afternoon. For boys turned men, the house was like purgatory, and just as Jeb left in search of heaven, Sonny stayed on for fear of finding hell. Jeb had two children, but he never brought them along on his visits. Sonny had met them only twice, when the first was a baby and again when the second was born. Back then, the mushrooms only grew in clumps around the edges of the yard, and the house still reminisced kindly on days past and lives. The hours passed unencumbered until noon. All right, so next up is our MC and also co-editor of the Gilletter, Willa. She's an awesome poet. She's an awesome writer. I personally really enjoy her work. I think it's lovely, and I'm really excited to hear what she has to share. So please welcome Willa.
Hi. I'm going to read my three poems that were in the Illicitor. This one was written after Hurricane Florence. I was walking to school, and this happened. Florence in the North. Last night, in a dream, I was garroted till death, with a length of clay-cutting wire. Yes,
I was a weak-mothered Ottoman prince of strong-willed brothers, and the throwing wheels were clean of all dust, and that was the shock of it. Breathed again when I saw morning glories, knew that once I had mortared them, rubbed that purple ointment into the flaking centers of my grandmother's palms, then her sister's, skin, in circles, like the rain systems, like the hurricanes whose last shaking absolutions break the banks of the river, lighten the brackishness, flood the parking lots, raise mulch and matter from the drains in brown leaf dunes. And after water, after the emperor's color crept up its vines and sunk me, it was all soft and tinted then, all real, like my own drought, like the flowers, which told me, you are living, which told me, the world is dirty, and so I knew. The next one is called Requiem of a Canada Goose. I am the biggest in the marsh. Forget the stripers washed in sometimes by the sea. Forget the heavy-bellied cranes with their heads down. Forget even the grasses which share roots for miles, all splintering between them what they suckle. I am bigger than that. Look not long at my compatriots and my wife, who follow me in the stratosphere, surround me in water. They are tiny and like children. I have more meat for Christmas, more bones for broth, more red waste to spill in the snow for the pigs and the dogs and the cat's tongues. I am the biggest in the marsh, bigger than the marsh, baby, and older and braver and realer even, like a fog coming in, a blanket on the mud. I have more down for pillows. And then the last one I'm going to read tonight is called Whispers of a Beekeeper. I am the liar. I am the loudmouth. You, the alien mucus of your tessellations. The rage that comes, clumps, with wax-clapped molars. The cold swelling of that rebel needle. The honey. I am smoke. I am death. I am landlord. I am that old and precious flower bent lightly towards the pond, tender as a baby chews before teeth, weighed by dew and a strange nameless longing, weighed by motherly imperialism. I am the liar. Sorry, sorry. I am the daffodil. Eat my money. So that's going to close us out for the evening. Thank you all so much for coming out and supporting the Elicitor and the arts at Gloucester High School. Feel free to take a copy of the magazine if you haven't already. We are accepting donations to fund our spring edition, which we are hoping to get out in June. So thank you all so much for coming.